Hello, this is Lisa Rosales Mora coming to you today from the Talking Information Center in Marshfield, Mass. And today is Wednesday, June 10th, 2026. And I will be reading from the latest issue, the June 2026 of Down East Magazine. And we will begin with an article on food, Blast from the Past, an old school burger joint. A chef returns to his roots. I was hungry for more than a meal when I stopped by Lee Frank's in South Berwick on a damp and chilly spring evening. The winter had felt like an endurance test, and I was hankering for a taste of summer, the kind of food you might detour for after a day at one of the nearby sandy beaches that snake along Maine's southern coast. For me, the meal most closely associated with the mingled scents of salt water and sunscreen is a cheeseburger and onion rings. Lee Frank might not be the first person you would expect to deliver this sort of fare. He is best known for his restaurant, Otis, in Exeter, New Hampshire, which offers a five-course tasting menu that changes weekly. That venture earned him a James Beard Award semifinalist nod in the Best Chef Northeast category in 2024 and 25. Otis is closing this spring, and Frank is launching a new restaurant, Maison, in Ogunquit. Last year, Frank made it to the final round on the NBC cooking competition Yes Chef, hosted by Martha Stewart and Jose Andres. Given that resume, you might expect the namesake burger joint Frank opened in his adopted hometown of South Berwick in 2021 and expanded with an Exeter location last year to serve elevated takes on classic dishes. Camembert on a grass-fed beef patty, perhaps? But Lee Frank's fully embraces an old-time burger shack vibe. A Los Angeles native, Frank wanted to create an homage to the greasy spoons and regional chains like In-N-Out Burger and Original Tommy's he loved as a kid. The focus is on simple, fresh, and fast, says Frank, who co-owns his restaurants with his wife, Brooke. We're not messing around with 90 different cheeses and all those different kinds of toppings. It's no frills. The space is similarly SoCal casual. An overlapping LF on a sign outside the mustard yellow building recalls the LA logo of the LA Dodgers, rendered in Dodgers royal blue. The lettering matches the doors, metal chairs and stools, and the menu board in the spare gray wall dining room. The menu divides into burgers, chili burgers, hot dogs, sides, and drinks categories. Frank borrowed from Carney's, another of his favorite LA haunts. A note at the bottom of the board invites customers to make any dish dirty with the addition of grilled onions and house-made Thousand Island-style sauce, a twist on In-N-Out annual-style offerings. I opted for the chili cheeseburger, which seemed dirty enough with its standard mustard, tomato, raw onion, dill pickle, and chili toppings. Inspired by the chili burger at Original Tommy's, it was slathered with the sauce as opposed to stew-like ground beef and tomato mixture, lightly spiced with chili powder, cayenne, and paprika for a satisfying kick. The food arrived at my table a few minutes after I ordered it, and I immediately headed back to the counter for a fork to scoop up the chili and melted American cheese that oozed from what I correctly guessed would soon become a structurally compromised bun. All of Lee Frank's burgers are smash burgers made by flattening a ball of ground beef on a blazing hot griddle. My patty was tender with lovely seared edges. The vinegary blast from the mustard and pickles was a little stronger than I like, but the burger was really the sideshow for me anyway. The onion rings, hand-sliced, soaked in buttermilk overnight and dredged in a seasoned mixture of flour and cornstarch before frying, were vanishingly thin with a delicate crispy coating. They were delicious on their own and dipped in a creamy house-made ranch dressing. On a second visit a few days later, I ordered the steamed New Yorker hot dog, an all-beef sausage from Mitty's Food in Connecticut. Wonderfully juicy, it protruded about an inch from either end of a steamed bun and was topped with tangy sauerkraut and brown mustard. Again, though, my side dish stole the show. This time it was a mound of thick, crinkle-cut fries, smothered in chili and melted with American cheese. While the topping soaked into some of the grooves, other areas remained delightfully crispy. I finished every last one. For dessert, I splurged, calorically speaking, on a chocolate milkshake, and the server mixed with a scoop of coffee ice cream when I couldn't decide on a flavor. Made with Giffords, it was luxuriously thick. I had to let it melt a bit before I could summon it with a straw. For me, Lee Frank's is a very back-to-roots, full-circle kind of place, Frank says. For some, it will undoubtedly evoke a cozy sense of nostalgia. For me, it conjured a bit of summer while I waited for Mother Nature to catch up. And that is in Dining, and that can be found at 12 Portland Street, South Berwick. And the prices range from $3.50 to $10 for burgers and hot dogs, and sides are $4 to $5.50. Shakes are $6. In addition to fries and onion rings, there are grilled cheese sandwiches, veggie burgers, and turkey burgers, and side salads. Great shakes. Choices include chocolate, vanilla, strawberry, and a daily special like strawberry cheesecake or blueberry crumble. Okay, that sounds delicious. Thinking big. In Dixmont Garden, peonies have an outsized impact. Summer arrives in Janet Fairman's front lawn with an explosion of coral and lemon yellow peonies. A week or so later, crimson, fuchsia, and pink varieties light up along a stone wall that curves around the front and side lawns, and a rainbow of the grapefruit-sized blossoms begins to pop open in gardens toward the back of the house. The property, perched in a clearing atop a hill that descends into a meadow and a peach and cherry orchard, sits exposed to high winds, drenching rain, and blazing sunlight. I've had to learn to accept that there are going to be failures, says Fairman, who has lost a number of flowering perennials over the years. Luckily, peonies are pretty resilient, and they're big, so you can make it a bouquet really impressive. The ones that smell like old-fashioned roses, I come inside with armloads. One of Fairman's earliest memories is of peering into a fragrant, ruffled peony blossom in the garden at her childhood home in a Chicago suburb. Her mother loved the flowers so much she transplanted bunches of them from her parents' nearby farm. I would spend the time outside with her, watching her plant, and she would teach me the names of the flowers, Fairman says. When Fairman got married, her mom decorated the church with giant bouquets of homegrown pink and white peonies. But there were no peonies perfuming the 24-acre parcel in Dixmont when Fairman and her husband purchased it in 2002. She promptly replaced several tall hedges blocking the gambrel-roofed home's front window with pink tree peonies. Later, she replaced those with coral and yellow bush varieties. It was a lot of work because the ground was still frozen. In June, she says, who moved from New Jersey to become a professor of education at the University of Maine. We were like, what? This is a crazy place. Over the next couple of decades, she focused on expanding the existing gardens that wrapped around the house, adding bulbs and perennials, peonies, of course, but also azaleas, hydrangeas, rhododendrons, daylilies, delphiniums, irises, and tulips that provide color throughout the growing season. She also put in a deck, patio, and sunroom and surrounded them with more gardens. Then, stuck at home during the pandemic, she had a revelation. I realized that if I'm inside the house, I can't see my garden. It was just grass, Fairman says. Zeroing in on spots that are visible through the home's windows, she planted pocket gardens near the top of the driveway, at the end of the stone wall beneath an oak tree, and along the edge of the woods in the backyard. Each is dedicated to one of her granddaughters, featuring flowers that bloom in their favorite colors around their birthdays. Along the middle section of the wall, overlooking a panorama of layered green hills, she planted a 40-foot-long peony border in a spectrum of rose shades, from whitish pink Petcher to magenta Paul M. Wild to scarlet Henry Boxtos. Today, 31 peony bushes, spanning 18 varieties, color the property. Fairman's granddaughters like helping her They like helping her in the garden, and she likes teaching them about her favorite plants. Someday, perhaps, the flowers will wind up in arrangements at their weddings or as transplants in their gardens, keeping Fairman's peony project alive for another generation. The West Paris Post Office has reopened after a 5-year closure. The previous office was shuttered abruptly in 2021 after its lease was not renewed. In the years that followed, residents were left with a single mail collection box that had to, and they had to drive nearly 10 miles to South Paris or Norway to visit a post office. Congressman Jared Goldman, who had introduced legislation aimed at preventing similar disruptions in other rural communities, announced the news in a press release. While the USPS should have been more prompt and transparent throughout this process, he wrote, this reopening is a happy ending to the saga. Life in pictures. Andy Malloy has passed away at age 57. A longtime photojournalist for the Kennebec Journal, Malloy was deeply embedded in the Augusta area community. Colleagues remember him trailing fire trucks and frequently arriving on the scenes of breaking stories before reporters. Molly grew up in Halliwell and graduated from Bard College in New York. Afterward, he worked as a paramedic in Brooklyn before starting his career at the Journal in 1995. Over the next 3 decades, he was a fixture at crime scenes, community events, and high school sports competitions, and he won numerous Maine Press Association awards. He was also an avid fly fisher and a registered Maine guide. He often took friends on trips to McGalloway River in Oxford County, among other spots. He died after a 10-year battle with cancer. Halliwell and the entire Augusta area are so much better for the fact that Andy Malloy lived, Michael Shepard, a former colleague, told the Bangor Daily News. That's really all you can hope for at the end of your life. He accomplished it. No spring chicken. Gertie, a 15-year-old golden Sebright, is officially at the top of the pecking order. Guinness World Records has recognized the Portland bird as the oldest living chicken. Shortly after Portland passed an ordinance allowing backyard hens, in 2009, Frank Turek purchased a brood that included Gertie. She lived in an outdoor coop with a few different flocks. The average lifespan of domestic hen is 6 to 8 years. For more than a decade, in 2024, though, she began going blind and the other birds attacked her. Today she resides in a crate in Turek's living room and remains quite plucky. She's pretty alert, he told the Portland Press. Sometimes I'll be singing something random and she'll look up and respond, and if you can say her name, she'll call back with a pup, pup, pup. And that's the story of Gertie, who's 15. And in a room with a view, beautiful ruins, finding life amid decay in the Maine woods. Elementary school wrapped in June, which meant more time at my grandparents' place on the Serpentine. Their modest red cabin with a screened-in porch that mosquitoes droned against faced the short, twisting stream between two ponds in the Belgrade Lakes. Before milfoil choked the Serpentine's oxygen, the water held large bass that I chased in the evenings. To kill time before fishing, I snuck the most rounded rocks from my grandparents' gravel driveway. In the stance of my favorite ball players, I tried to clear the river with my wiffle ball bat or one of Grandpa's woodshop table legs. Apparently, that gravel wasn't cheap, and when he noticed ball spots growing in the driveway, my days of home run derby were over. So I did what kids in rural Maine do. Explore. The vacant neighboring lot was tall pines that kept constant shade even on the brightest, hottest afternoons. Among the orange pine needles and myriad sticks and mushrooms were larger logs and branches and abandoned firewood stacks, mostly mossed over and splintering in various stages of decay. Some logs were too heavy to budge or had already sunk far into the ground, as if the earth were swallowing them. When I pushed with the might of my scrawny arms on smaller logs, of a layer of bark was sometimes left behind, stuck in a muddy indent like they were shedding their skin. Occasionally, the simple act of rolling a log would disintegrate it. To my surprise, life crawled from the debris. Crouching, I inspected the segmented shells of sow bugs, loving the way they rolled into a protective ball. Out came alien millipedes with their bristly legs, their nastier pinching centipede neighbors, and various spiders, earthworms, and slugs. I tried unsuccessfully to pull root strands. I learned the word mycelium. I stomped on puffballs to admire their puffs. I dug in the dirt with my bare hands. Once in a while, I took night crawlers back with me as bait, but most of the time I left them undisturbed in their cozy dirt lairs. I loved the surprise of it in the same way I loved advent calendars. What might I discover under the next log? I'd wander deeper into the forest, farther from my grandparents' cabin, with plenty of time before dinner and my evening fishing sessions. With the dirt road on one side and the serpentine on the other, it was impossible to get lost. I'd search for new old logs to flip. On one of those summer afternoons, I flipped a log in the dark woods, and there, curled and surely squished, was a spotted salamander. It reminded me of the shiny black licorice. I marveled at its impossibly bright yellow spots. How did a creature so dazzling live in such darkness? When I felt its skin, it flinched, came to life. I was probably the first person to ever see this particular creature. I wondered about its eyesight and what it took me for. Gently, I moved the log back in place. It felt nice as a relatively shy kid to meet these relatively shy beings living hidden but so close by. Those afternoons, explorations became ritual. I left logs undisturbed for a week or so and then returned and expanded my search area. I also found eastern red-backed salamanders and eastern newts. The newts were bright as a highlighter, orange as the ripest clementine. I mostly watched them. I had learned that the salt on my hands harmed their delicate skin. The newts had tiny planetary orbs on their flanks, not unlike the spots of wild brook trout I caught on nearby streams. Back at the cabin for dinner, I washed my hands, scrubbing away the grit embedded in my skin. My fishing rod rested in a corner near the door, night crawlers cooling in the container in the fridge. Dinner was always on this green porch, Granny Annie and Grandpa Al and me suppressing the urge to scarf the spaghetti and meatballs in her signature sweet red sauce so I could get on with fishing. They asked me questions I didn't fully hear. I knew nothing about decay and the serpentines of time. From the serpentine came the croaks of bullfrogs. June bugs buzzed and clicked and smacked the screen, trying to get in. Maine has been a hotbed of the arts for centuries. Today is no different, with museums, galleries, and studios exhibiting artists who continue to use their craft to depict Maine in all its forms and textures. Make the destinations on this list part of your itinerary the next time you're looking to explore Maine's art scene. And we have the Artemis Galley in Northeast Harbor, Maine, Bates College Museum of Arts in Lewiston, Maine, Blue Raven Gallery in Rockland, Maine, Colby College Museum of Art in Waterville, Courthouse Gallery of Fine Art in Ellsworth, Dunn Studios in various locations, and Gallery at Summer Sound, Mount Desert in Maine, Gleason Fine Art, Inc., Booth Bay Harbor. Those are all wonderful places for galleries. The New Wave. Droves of painters have found their way to Maine over the centuries, drawn to glancing light, lush woods, and rocky shores. Winslow Homer, Edward Hopper, Lois Dodd, Rockwell Kent, David Driscoll, Marston Hartley, Georgia O'Keeffe, and Andrew Wyeth, to name a few. Some simply passed through, others became deeply identified with the state, joining the outsized canon of great Maine artists. The vast majority of names in that canon, though, have been there a good while, and at some point an update will be in order. So we polled curators from across Maine's museums, many of which have put added emphasis on up-and-coming talent lately, about contemporary artists they suspect we'll all still be talking about a long time from now. Those curators provided no shortage of suggestions, but five painters came up the most. They're introduced here, representatives of the vanguard keeping the state's creative spirit alive and well. Jay Stern, early 2000s skateboard culture in suburban central Ohio, might seem like an unlikely origin story for a painter, Bates College Museum of Art assistant curator Samantha Sigmund compares to the likes of Carl Spritchhorn and Paul Cezanne. For Jay Stern, though, skateboarding was a formative visual culture with its all-important board and t-shirt designs, fostering an appreciation for color and symbolism. I grew up paying attention to iconography and the connection between visual art and culture. Stern also thinks that the in-betweenness of his suburban life at the junction of natural and built environments honed his eye. It trained me to pay attention and decipher what is real, he says. He saw rooms as puzzles with pieces to arrange to assemble the self anew. Before you come out, all I have is my bed, my dresser, and my NYSC poster. Stern moved to the Mid-Coast in 2021, and as he put down roots, he became more captivated by natural landscapes and the idea of its rural settings. There's something about the feel that makes me feel both at peace and terrifies me. I'm making sense of my place and the place. James Parker Foley. Standing by rows of paint tubes on a table in his Portland studio, James Parker Foley picked one up. "This is Pigment Blue 29," he said. "Ultramarine synthetic. You can also crush a similar color out of lapis lazuli, which is mined in Afghanistan and incredibly expensive, but that's like this color." He puts the tube back among the dozen-plus shades of blue, then grabbed another magnase. "It's still mined for industrial uses, but no longer," he noted, "for art supplies because of its catastrophic environmental impact, so I don't get to use it a lot." "This one," he continued, "is Yi In Min, which was accidentally discovered by a scientist in Oregon. He heated indium and manganese and put them on a kiln while he was trying to do something else, and it was like, wow, that's really beautiful." Foley's work has helped him come to comprehend his identity. Shuffling through a sheath of drawings he made a few years ago, he pulled out Point of No Return, showing a figure going into a traffic cone. Foley has found that his art creates space for his personal discovery. It also taps into the universal. There's something really poetic about his use of the figure. They are nameless, faceless, and he has described it to me as not really representing people in the world, but inner beings. East of Eden, Benjamin Williamson has a keen sense for the subtleties of Maine landscapes, the vagaries of Maine weather, and the striking ways those two things conspire. His dreamy photographs, sunsets flaring, harbors glassy, northern lights aglow, have won a wide following and made countless appearances in this magazine. But the first time Williamson took the boat out to see Machias, Seal Islands, resonant puffins, he felt plucked from his usual element. Wild photography requires, among other things, an understanding of the wildlife, and Williamson was equally delighted and perplexed as he peered through a small opening in a shared blind and tried to time the snap of his lens with the bird's wobbly landings and jouncy waddling. Eventually, Williamson found a rhythm, and now, for the past several years, he and fellow photographers J.K. Putnam and Nathaniel Child have been teaming up to lead photo workshops on Machias Sea Island, one of just a handful of islands along the Maine coast that supports nesting puffins. The scrubby granite outcrop is mostly off-limits to anyone other than seabird researchers and Canadian lighthouse keepers. Canada and the U.S. have long staked competing claims to the island, but it's the Canadian government that built the light station as well as designated a migratory bird sanctuary. Just two tour operators, one from each country, are permitted to come ashore. Bold Coast Charter Company in Cutler is the American outfit, and Williamson's Workshop Group reserves trips on its 40-foot boat for three consecutive mornings in early summer. If conditions allow, they'll go out every day, more often than not. Trips to Machias Sea Island run as scheduled, although weather on the intervening 10 miles of ocean sometimes precludes it. As much as Williamson enjoys photographing puffins, he doesn't mind being stuck on shore. On those days, the group makes alternate excursions, rambling along trails in a tranquil part of the state that, compared to the rest of the coast, relatively few travelers ever experience. It always feels romantic, he says, getting away from it all. He presents a mix of photos from his workshop mixes on those idyllic days when he got to see puffins and on those idyllic days when he didn't. How to explore down east? Plan ahead for puffins on the Bold Coast Charter. Other boat trips. Cutler Harbor offers tour company offers lighthouse and lobstering cruises. Travel by foot and stay and eat. Williamson's group stays at the Eastland Motel, eastlandmotel.com, a classic roadside place, a short drive from downtown Lubbock. And those are just some places where you can explore photography down east and shoot puffins and other beautiful sights. And that ends today's reading of Down East. Thank you very much for listening, and have a wonderful week.